Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of eight cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
Osiris.
Welcome to Wheels Off, a show about the messy reality of the creative life. I'm Rhett Miller.
That's when it got wheels off. We started up and we ain't gonna stop. Oh, I like you, like it or not. That's when it got wheels off.
When F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote "There Are No Second Acts in American Lives," he clearly had not met Mara Wilson. Mara has done more in her brief life than most of us could ever dream of doing in our long, hopefully long lives. She was a child actor. You probably know her from Matilda or Mrs. Doubtfire or any number of movies that she did when she was young, really young. And she has matriculated to a life as a writer. She still, I think, acts and performs some, but she identifies primarily and works primarily as a writer these days. And she's brilliant. She's always had a lot to say. She's an activist as well as an author and an actor. She is a deep thinker. I mean, all of this will quickly become apparent as you listen to our conversation. I don't know Mara super well, but I've gotten to spend enough time around her to have always wanted her as a guest on this show. It took a while to just line it up, lives being what they are. But I'm so glad that I finally got to sit down with and pick the brain of the great Mara Wilson. So please welcome to this most recent episode, the newest and best yet episode of Wheels Off. This is the great Mara Wilson. Welcome to Wheels Off, Mara Wilson. Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, I'm so glad. I feel like I've been wanting to do this since I met you in person 2 years ago.
Was it only 2 years ago? It feels like 100.
I know, it does. It does. But like, I was having a really hard year that year. And like, going to Austin was one of the high points of my year, for sure.
We hung out at Stubbs.
Yes, we did. And we hung out after, and my publicist Heidi was there. And Heidi's like one of my best friends in addition to being my publicist. And you know, she's a big fan of yours too. So we were really excited to hang out after, and like none of us drink. So we just like drank tons of LaCroix and we like sat around. I feel like there was a campfire, and your sister showed up and she was so sweet. Yeah. And I was like, this is great. And it's really nice when you meet somebody that, you know, you really admire and like you really like their artwork and stuff, and they end up being like a cool, relatable person too.
Oh, that's very sweet.
That was really nice. Yeah, Heidi and I were like, he's so nice. And he just like talks so highly about his wife and kids and like his bandmates. And like, we were just like, he's a really cool guy. I was like, yeah, he genuinely is. So that was a great show too.
Thank you so much.
I had a lot of fun in Austin that time. The last time, the time before that I went to Austin, it rained the whole time and I didn't really get to do anything. Mm. So it was nice to see it in a different light. I know. Almost literally in a different light.
And we were at a big outdoor show and it was a beautiful evening.
It was.
Oh, I love that. Well,
that was a really great time.
As far as speaking highly of all those people, it's true. I guess I do believe that, like, surround yourself with people who you want to build up, right?
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, like, I'm really close with like my brothers and sisters, and I have a lot of friends and people that I feel like I'm very loyal to. And that's, And that's really important. And I mean, some people I work with, like business-wise, and it's very much like, this is just business. But other people like Heidi, who you met, are, I'm like, you're somebody I know and you're somebody I trust, you know? And that's really important to me. And I also think that probably you can relate to this too, because you started performing at a young age. I think if you start performing at a young age, sometimes it's very hard to trust people.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you encounter a lot of people who want to be friends with you or date you or work with you for the wrong reasons.
Yeah, that's a really tricky thing, I guess.
Yeah. So when people earn your trust, it's you know, it's really important. And I think that not everybody has family that's like really there for them, and not everybody has like partners and kids that they like really like to be close with and everything. But I think it's, you know, you should really treasure that when you do.
I mean, you just made me realize that's probably part of why so many people that start really young wind up, you know, getting caught up in stuff that they might not otherwise, where their better judgment might keep them from it later.
I mean, I could talk about this for hours. I could make, I mean, I've spoken in documentaries about this. I've written articles for, you know, for like the New York Times and Elle and like all kinds of places for the, about this topic. But yeah, it's true. And when you're young, I also think, I know for me, like I was kind of a people pleaser when I was young, but some people can be people pleasers and are just kind of a go with the flow person. And I'm really not. So I would people please, but then I would like secretly be pissed off about it later and be like, oh, why did I say yes to that? And that can be really hard too, because then people think, oh, well, you're not a nice person. I don't want to work with you. And it's just like, no, it's just that I couldn't assert myself earlier. You know, I couldn't set a healthy boundary. So yeah, that's a problem.
Well, yeah. I appreciate you agreeing to be interviewed by me for Wheels Off. I'll be gentle with you. And
it's fine. I'm kind of an open book.
So what creative project are you working on right now, and how does it light you up?
Oh, man. I mean, I have a couple different things that I'm working on. And like, I started writing something that's like kind of based on experiences I had as a teenager, and in like a world that I was in as a teenager. And that's been really fun. And I developed all these things, but then my manager like looked at it and was like, this is great, but can you just go back and just tell me stories from that period of your life? And off the record, it was about my experiences at art boarding school. But so I basically just went in and I wrote down all of these like, all of the weirdest, crazy stories that I had from that age, just like a girl I knew who made a Ouija board out of a pizza box, and like, and just like all these people that I knew that were like kind of eccentric, and like, and like the people that that I met, and all of these, you know, living in a forest, living in places that caught fire regularly, which happens when you live in Southern California, wow, that kind of stuff, and it was really fun. I mean, I think that a lot of my favorite stuff to do is to look at the things that seem very mundane to me that were actually quite weird, or mundane to other people that are actually really quite weird, and be like, this is, look at how freaking weird this is, guys. Look at all the strangeness in this. Or look at the things that, yeah. So, or look at the things that seemed normal to me, but definitely were not normal, which happened a lot in my childhood for several reasons.
So, do you think that this thing you're working on might turn into another memoir kind of thing?
Maybe, or I mean, I would love for it to be like a show or a movie. I think I really like dramatic writing. I think I think that like when I was young, I had three older brothers who were very smart, and I describe them as very smart smartasses. They were kind of like they were all very, very bright, but they all, or maybe one or two of them more than the others, had kind of like a Ferris Bueller thing going on. And I know he's probably going to listen to this, and they're going to know which one I was talking about. But we had a lot of really good times together, you know, and I was always listening to what they had to say. And I mean, one of my brothers is a college professor now, and they all have at least master's degrees or PhDs. My sister's probably going that way too. They're all very smart in a very academic kind of way. And so I learned a lot from them, and I listened to a lot of things. And I think that I also listen into a lot of adult conversations and just I was surrounded by adults a lot. So I heard a lot of people talking. And I think that the way that I think is kind of in words and in talking. That's something that I find really interesting. And that's something that at some point I would love to hear from you. Like, do you think in words? Do you think in music? Do you think in sounds and you know, or in images? Because I almost never think in images. I think in sounds. Like when I talk in my brain, when I have an inner monologue, it usually feels like I'm having either a dialogue with myself or like I'm being interviewed or like something, or it's a dialogue, but also, I mean, I spent my childhood reading scripts. So for me, writing dialogue, when I went to college, I took a playwriting class and I had always loved writing. I was pretty good at every kind of writing except poetry. For some reason, I couldn't do poetry very well. But I had never really found like the one kind of writing that I thought was best for me. I was definitely the kind of kid who like knocked out an essay the night before it was due and still got an A, which saved me many, many times because I was a very distracted student. But I got to college and I took a playwriting class. And that's where it felt like something really just clicked for me. Because my playwriting teacher was like, you're really good at dialogue. And I was like, oh yeah, all these years of eavesdropping have totally paid off. And I think that's really one of my favorite things to write. I mean, I'm lucky in that I just like to write, period. Like I'd probably be happy writing any kind of thing for the rest of my life. But dialogue is really my favorite thing because I think the things that people say and the things that they don't say reveal so much about them. And I love hearing different people's dialects and different people's accents and different people's strange phrases and phrases that they learned from other languages that they brought into their life and those kinds of things. That's something that I've always been, you know, in love with. And I think that ideally I would love to write more dialogue. I would love to write more plays, but writing for TV, writing for film, that's definitely something that I want to do more of. So, yeah.
It's funny because what you do nowadays with your life is, you know, most with some performing and mostly writing, right?
Yeah.
But I wonder, you might have just kind of answered this, but I wonder if there was a moment when you were really young, because obviously you were, you know, started working so early in a thing that you no longer do primarily. I wonder if there was a moment when you were really young when you knew, like, I'm going to be a writer. Like, I identify as a writer. Did you have, like, an epiphany moment? And were you already doing this other crazy job?
I always knew I wanted to be a writer. I wanted to be a writer ever since I knew what a writer was. I knew that. And actually, the way that I got into acting was I liked to tell stories. And so we have so many home videos of me telling stories and me acting them out and just little one-woman shows over and over again. And My dad would talk about, he'd be like, you would start one story in the morning and I would go to work and I would come home and you were still telling the same story and we'd go to bed and the next morning you'd be telling the same story and I'd go to work again and I'd come back and you'd still be telling the same story. Like these were epics and I always acted them out. And I think that performing my story, like it got to the point where I would say, I have a story. Once upon a time, and my brothers would go, oh, good story, and clap. So I would stop. But I really loved that. I really loved telling stories. That was what I wanted to do. And I think it's probably because, like, my mom was very, she was a very theatrical woman. She was, I kind of can't describe her as any way other than, like, a force. You know, she was like a Frances McDormand character. She was always very good at very performative, you know, telling stories, things that were very little. She just, like, added all these heights and stuff to it. And one of my brothers had done a little bit of acting and he had that gift for storytelling too. Like he told me some of the funniest stories ever. And they were just really stupid little things about like things that had happened. Like he once made me laugh harder than I'd ever laughed in my life by talking about how the washing machine stretched out one of his shirts. Like, that was just the story. But the way that he told it was so funny that I was crying laughing. So that was something that was in my family. Storytelling was a thing. And my dad is a very quiet guy. He's an engineer. He's painfully pragmatic. But if you get my dad to tell a story, it is the most entertaining. And he keeps them to himself. So, like, I remember, like, I think two Thanksgivings ago, or maybe it was Christmas time, he told us about how right after the 1994 earthquake, he was fixing a helicopter because he's an engineer that works for a news station. That's what he does. He was fixing a helicopter and there was an aftershock and the aftershock lifted the helicopter off the ground and dropped it back down again. And we were like, that's really scary. Were you okay? He was like, yeah, I was fine. But he told us this story and he told us about like how everything went quiet and how terrifying it was. And I was just like, this is just something you've kept in your back pocket for 25 years. And apparently, yeah. So storytelling was a thing in my family. And I knew that that was what I wanted to do. And I always admired people who were really good at telling stories. And I think like my first acting coach, John Homa, and my like the a studio teacher that I had, Richard Wickland, they were very good at telling stories. And that was really when I bonded with people, and how I bonded with people was by telling stories.
Did it feel weird for you that you were living this one life of a performer and in your mind you were identifying as a storyteller, as a writer?
It did. It definitely did. And I would always, like, I would go back to my trailer. And I know Evan Rachel Wood has said, you can always tell children who acted as, you can always tell people who acted as children because they always have weird hobbies. And it's true. Like, I remember mastering, like, Cat's Cradle and like, making miniature things and doing all kinds of, like, very specific stuff and, like raising hamsters, like, very weird specific stuff that you do in your trailer between sets and between shots. And I always write stories. And there's probably, and scripts, too. I really wanted to make scripts and I really wanted to, like, make a movie. And I remember especially after my mother died, I really wanted to write about a girl who was like an international spy, but she was only like 13. And they were hunting down like some terrorist or something. And the terrorist had killed her partner, like her work partner's mother. And I don't think I realized at the time that like how much of that was just me grieving and how much of that was just me trying to process, you know, the death of my mother and the pain that I was going through. And thinking of the days, I think that I imagined that like when I was 13, I would feel bigger and stronger. And so I wrote about a character who was kind of, she was cool and she was a tomboy and she was everything I wanted to be. And she was based on like an actress that I'd worked with that I kind of had like, I don't know if it was like a girl crush or like an actual crush, but I thought that this girl was really cool. And it's so interesting to me when I think back on that. And I'm just like, wow, writing was really how I processed things. And they're probably still in like my parents' garage is like a copy of that, like the screenplay that I really wanted to make. And I don't know. I don't know if I thought I was going to like just make it in the backyard with some friends or if I thought it would be like an actual movie. I mean, I think I was kind of spoiled by the process. You know, that and I was like, I could produce a movie. It's fine. You know, I'm an acting in movies, which, you know, people always think that child actors are spoiled brats. And I don't think that we are, but you have to be kind of entitled to think that when you're 9 years old, you're going to actually get your screenplay made.
that comes up a lot in these conversations, the therapy of the act of creating art. And it actually comes up a lot, just the therapy of consuming art, viewing art, you know. I would even argue that just talking about the process, the impulse is definitely part of it. I remember speaking to Harlan Coben for one of these, the novelist, and he talked about his series character, Myron Bolitar, who has these really strong parents who are in, you know, all of the books, and they have this incredible relationship. And he talks about that as being sort of this wish fulfillment because his parents died young. Yeah. And he was able to write. Kind of get choked up even just thinking about it. It was so sweet. He's able to write the relationship he wanted to have with them.
Yeah. That is really interesting to me. The idea of writing, you know, what you wish you could have. And there's so many times in my life where I wrote something and then later on I was like, oh, that's what that was. That was me working through, you know, I wrote something that was about like a girl whose parents died in a car crash. And I realized later, you know, one of my family members was in a car crash that was really dangerous when I was, and like almost killed them when I was the summer I turned 18. And I remember later being like, oh yeah, that really scared me. And that might be the reason why I don't have my license. And I was writing this book and I was just like, this girl, I was like, wow, this character is so terrified of driving. And I was like, oh, well, maybe that has to do with something. And then I'm like, oh, well, maybe that has to do with me. Or like, I also tried to write a book where like a teenage girl fell in love with a girl for the first time. And later on I realized, okay, that was me trying to acknowledge that that had happened to me too. It did not go very well for me, but for her, it went very nicely, where she fell in love with this girl and this girl loved her back and was very sweet to her. Whereas with me, it you know, did not end nicely at all. And I kind of, you know, hid from that part of myself for years after that because of that. So it is, and I always say that fiction is way more revealing than nonfiction, because with nonfiction, you reveal yourself consciously. With fiction, you reveal yourself unconsciously. Yeah,
it's funny your point about looking back on it, something you've created later and being able to see it.
Yeah,
more for what it is, perhaps to see behind your inspiration. I've always found that to be the case as well. Or I'll play it for my mom and she'll go, "Oh, that's about," and then she'll tell
me. Yeah. Well, I mean, I feel like that with a lot of your songs, because some of your songs I feel like are very clearly characters you're playing, and some of them are very clearly I'm like, oh, this is probably. Like I remember thinking like indefinitely, I was like, oh, this sounds like a fun story. And then you were like, oh, it's actually based on a true story. and I was like, oh, this is such a funny story. He thought, of. Oh, wait. And it's funny. And I mean, I don't feel like I feel like it's not really, I don't think we should demand to know, like, did this happen? Did this not happen? You know, I do think that today, that these days, I think we kind of expect a little too much of public figures in our lives. And I think it's because with social media, we know these things, but I also think with social media, there's a little bit of familiarity breeding contempt.
Yeah.
And you really know people, but you don't, I mean, and this is my sociology minor talking, but like, I think social ties are the most important things in the world. Social ties are really what keep people going. And, you know, and that's, and I think that's social ties. Yeah. Social ties are everything. And when you find somebody online and you really like their stuff, and when you find somebody you really like their stuff and you find them online, you don't have a social tie with them. You know, you might have the word parasocial is thrown a lot, but you might have a parasocial relationship with them, but you don't actually know them. You don't actually have a social tie. And that makes it really easy for you to discard them when you find out that they've disappointed you. Oh. Whereas in real life, like I've talked to, I remember I was talking to like my sister or something. And I was like, well, social ties, you know, make the difference for us. Like I told her, I was like, do you think that cheating on somebody is wrong? And my sister was like, yeah, absolutely. It's wrong. And I said, okay, but we have friends who've cheated on their boyfriends or girlfriends, you know, or husbands or wives, and we're still friends with them. And my sister was like, okay, but that situation was different because there was this factor. And, you know, and okay, so they cheated, but it's not that big of a deal. And I'm like, okay, but that's the thing. You want to believe in absolutes, but you can't because social ties get in the way, and we're willing to forgive people for these things, I think, because we love them, because we care about them, because we know them. And so sometimes I'll see people be like, why is this famous person still hanging out with this famous person? And I think if they do something egregious enough, you know, you probably want to, you know, leave them. If they've committed like a crime or if they really hurt somebody, you know, that's definitely it. But when they've just done something or said something stupid, it's because people know them and it's because of social ties. And I also think this is why in the past year I've been less on social media. And I think it's also like, I had this feeling for a long time that like I needed to be, and I never considered myself political, but I did consider myself an advocate for like all kinds of causes and, you know, and things like mental health. And like, I have a lot of chronic health problems and I'm trying to like get the word out about them and things. But like, I don't know. One of my brothers said to me, you know, you don't always have to be a paladin. And I've reminded myself of that. Like, you know, there's other people out there who know more about these issues, who are doing more for this. I can do this in very, you know, quiet ways. I can quietly give money. I can amplify other people's voices. I can retweet them. I can post things, you know, and not make it about myself and not make it about me saying like really edgy things or, and doing that. And I feel better now that I do that, I think. And it also takes, when I took the energy away from that, I was able to channel it into my own creative acts, I think, which is great because I think that, I mean, I don't want to use the word addictive, but I do think that, for lack of a better term, a lot of social media is addictive because it's an instant rush. And so like, I'm still on Twitter, but it's usually just to promote things or talk about friends' things or like charity and mutual aid work that I do with friends and fundraising for different groups or things like that, or to promote projects. And every now and then tweet something like kind of funny, but I don't rely on it the way that I used to. I think that I've moved away from it and I've been happier doing that because it's just too complicated and it's too hard. You want to try to please everybody and that is impossible.
I wonder if there's like a finite amount of energy that you have, and if you pour it into Twitter, that it can't go into your screenplay.
That's what people always told me, you know, and I would have teachers tell me, like I would run into one of my old teachers from college when I still lived in New York, and they would be like, I see you're on Twitter a lot. Shouldn't you be putting that into a play? And I was like, yeah, I probably should. And I also think that the past few years, like even before the pandemic, I started dealing with some health problems and pain. And that was really frustrating. And there were times when I couldn't work, when I didn't have the energy to work. And I went out, like I was out in LA and I was like pitching scripts and I was doing voiceover roles and I was like having a lot of fun. And then I got sick and I kind of did never get better. And then like right when I thought that I was getting better, I had another kind of sickness sneak up on me and I was like, great, this is fantastic. So I had to deal with that a lot. And I think that I probably put more of myself into, you know, the internet than using the internet as a jumping off point, which was always my goal. So I think that I do feel like there is, in some ways, there is kind of a finite amount of energy and there is sort of that back and forth. And it's short-term versus long-term, I think, is the best way of doing it, of thinking about it, because you can make short-term things and you can make a funny joke and people will laugh about it and, you know, we'll remember it, or you can make something that's really going to last. Well, and it's hard, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I've always admired the way that you advocate for mental health, for instance.
Thank you.
And that kind of stuff. I really feel like your openness about it and confronting it head on and shedding a light on things that people are afraid to talk about is really great. And, I think it's really cool that you've been so open about, you know, your own stuff. And I wonder if, you know, for the sake of our listeners, when you encounter those things that keep you from being able to create, you know, to focus your energy on the constructive things that you want to do with it, what have you figured out as far as a way through that? What strategies have you come up with to get past those obstacles?
It's been really hard because, I mean, I don't think I realized how much, because I've always had mental health problems. I've always been an anxious person. I had OCD since I was a very young child. And actually, the weekend that I met you in person, I was speaking at an OCD conference. I was the keynote speaker. So I had just given a speech about mental health. And there was actually another organization in Texas that, I remember I had done something for, and they were talking about other people who'd done it, and they were like, oh yeah, Rhett Miller did a commercial for us too. And I was like, oh my gosh. I was like, oh, I love the old 97s. And they were like, yeah, he did something for us. It was great. I think that one thing that I really don't like is the idea that you have to be depressed to make art. You know, I think there are a lot of like really interesting outsider artists who kind of used their outsider status and their weirdness and their you know, mental illness and stuff to create really interesting things. But that doesn't mean that you have to be, you know, a lot of times it's when you're at your healthiest, I think, that you make your best art. I think that the way that I always say it is like sometimes you can see something that's like really raw and interesting, but a lot of the times raw things aren't that interesting. And I know because I spent a lot of time seeing performance art and theater in New York. and what I always describe it, and I'm a tea drinker, so this analogy might not be right, but it's sort of like how coffee needs to be filtered. And I always know, like, because I used to do a lot of storytelling where I would tell a lot of funny stories on stage, kind of, you know, not this American Life type stuff. There was a really big scene of that in New York in the 2010s. And I would do a lot of that. But I knew, like, if something was going to make me cry to talk about, I wasn't ready to talk about it.
Mm.
And there were some people who would get up on stage and they would tell their stories and they would cry, or maybe they didn't mean to cry, but they would. And I was like, that's okay for them. But I personally know for me, I need to get it filtered. I need to get it filtered. And I need there to be, like, you know, and sometimes it will be like, I just broke up with somebody, but it'll be like, okay, I'm going to wait a month or so before I talk about having broken up with somebody. And I'm not going to go into detail about it because I want to respect their privacy and I want to do this. And I mean, I think that is really, like, for me, I've always needed processing time. I've always needed, you know, different ways to do that. And I think that I found a lot of different ways of, like, dealing with pain and things. But I do know that there were times when I was, like, when I was in pain and when I was having, like, a lot of health problems, I would get really depressed. And it was depressed in a way that I wasn't used to. And I feel like it's probably because when you're sick, it's like your whole nervous system is like, ah, I'm in danger. So you get depressed in, like, a totally different way. And really the things that helped me the most were things that were very meditative and just doing, like, the basic, like, grounding exercises and things like that. And one thing that I got really into that I really love. And the thing is, I don't, because of my health problems, because I have blood pressure problems, I don't drink, I don't smoke. I can't use weed in any way because that messes with your blood pressure. And I can't have caffeine. So a lot of the things that a lot of other people use to escape, I can't. And that's been really interesting. And a lot of my friends now are sober. And I feel like at my best when I'm talking with them a lot of the times, because I also don't think I realized I was never that big into those things. But I definitely would use alcohol to unwind. I would definitely use caffeine to focus. And I didn't realize how different life was going to be without them. So, and that also made me a little depressed and a little irritable because I didn't have those crutches anymore. So, like, one thing I do that I really love is I do flotation tanks, like isolation tanks, which is weird, I know, but I was recommended it by a friend who is a neuroscientist. And then I was recommended it by a friend who is, like, she was my roommate at boarding school, and she like scales mountains and leads, like, kayak tours and does all these big adventurous things. And she's, like, very outdoorsy and spiritual. And I was thinking to myself, I was like, okay, if, like, one of my most spiritual friends and one of my most scientific friends say that this is cool and this has been good for their mental health, I'm going to try it. And I really liked it because I have trouble focusing when I'm, like, trying to meditate, trying to relax. But there, it felt like somebody else was doing that for me. And I mean, I've heard people talk about, like, how psychedelics help them. I don't think I'm ever going to do that stuff because it scares me too much. But some people told me, they were like, oh, you did basically have, like, dreamy psychedelic experiences in there, but it was all just your own mind. And so that was kind of cool too. So I've been doing that, and I always find myself much more calm and grounded after I do them. And there's a place here in LA that does them that I really like. And they know me now. And I go in there and it's just very dark. And I end up, usually I end up, like, singing songs to myself and just feeling, but I also think there's something very purifying about water. I mean, I think, like, in like almost every religion, there's an idea of, like, purifying yourself in water spiritually and grounding yourself by being in water. And I think that there's really something to that. You know, there's baptism, there's mikvah, there's bathing in the Ganges River, there's, you know, washing yourself before you pray in Islam. There's, like, it's in everything, really. And so I think that water is a very, like, centering thing for me. And so that weirdly really helped me. And it's helped me be really creative and relaxed and much more comfortable with myself.
It's crazy how much meditation comes up during this portion of the discussion.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, people, think about the noisy, the chaos of our world, you know, right?
Yeah.
When I was a teenager, my mom going through a divorce got us both inducted into transcendental meditation.
Yeah.
And they have a concept in there called the unified field. So when you finally sink down to a state of no thought, you're in the unified field, and you by definition can't be aware that you're in the field while you're in it. It's only as you come out of it. But I haven't done the the flotation tank thing.
Yeah.
Yet, but I'm
not a lot
intrigued.
Of people have, but it's very interesting. And it's very, yeah, it's, but I think if you can, if you're already like good at meditating, like my sister tried it and she was like, oh, that was okay. I liked it. But for me, I came out of it and I was, you know, like sobbing with joy. And I feel like I've gone through a cathartic experience in there with like grief and love and all of these things. And I feel like I love myself and I love the world. And I had like, you know, I came out telling her like, you're like a flower. You're so beautiful. And she was just kind of like, yeah, I kind of meditated in there and it was nice, but she's also very good at meditating, I think. Whereas with me, my mind is all over the place. My mind is very noisy. So I always say that my mind is like somebody emptied a kitchen junk drawer onto a trampoline and there's a bunch of rowdy preteens jumping on it. So whereas she's a lot more focused and she's a lot more grounded. And so for me, it was kind of like I needed that outside force to help.
Oh. Mara, that's you know. So good. I'm so sorry.
Yeah. I'm working on it. Yeah.
No, it's great. I think your mental chaos is our gain, perhaps.
I hope so. And I hope that I can make, you know, the most out of it. I have found that always imagining the worst case scenario can make for very good comedy.
I'm sure my son would have something to say about the visualization that you're doing and how you need to manifest, you know, something positive or whatever. It's funny though. I made the joke about your mental chaos is our gain, but yet just moments ago, I was agreeing with you as you were saying that this myth of the depressed artist as being like depression being somehow fodder for art or, or for fertile ground or whatever. I agree with you. I think that's incredibly damaging.
Yeah.
But it's funny. So yeah, I'm not sure by my joking, I guess my point is, that I can tell there's a lot going on inside your brain. And
I think
it's charming and I think it's great. And I think it's what makes you, you, but I can understand because I think it's gotta be a lot to live with that.
It is. I mean, it really is. And you know, I am as most people are a combination of my mother and father. Mm-hmm. and my mother was very intense and very, she'd been through a lot and she could be very dramatic and very over the top. And she had a lot of feelings and my mother struggled a lot with mental health stuff too. And some of that was intergenerational trauma going back from, you know, us being Jewish during pogroms in Lithuania and Ukraine and the way that that affects you. And some of that was, you know, just her own family and her own genetics. And then there was my dad, and my dad's side of the family is, I mean, they're bright, but they're like kind of ADHD and they're very pragmatic people. And they're very, down to earth and very funny and like very kind. Like my dad is so kind that like, he wouldn't let us watch American Idol when we were teenagers. Cause he thought it was too mean. Oh. He was like, it's so mean the way that they're, and it's funny because my dad is also very conservative in some ways and very like has a libertarian streak and is like, everybody needs to leave me alone. But he's very gentle. If you see him with like a dog or a baby, you know, he's the sweetest guy in the world. And he totally has like engineer brain too, which is like, you know, practical. The joke is like that an optimist looks at a glass and says it's half full. Pessimist says it's half empty. The engineer says that it's like this percent too big. It's all about efficiency. So I feel like I'm kind of, I've got like a mix of like my mom's theatricality, but also my dad's practicality. And that's an interesting mix. And it's something I see in my family too, because like we're all pretty sciencey to some extent or like pretty analytical to some extent. But like all of us had an interest in music at one point. And all of us played, like one of my brothers was really into drums. Another one played bass. Another one played guitar. And my sister and I sang, and my sister also played oboe for a while. And I tried to pick up guitar, piano. I did one semester in band percussion. I did, I did lots of years in choir. And for a while we were like, we could start a family band. And then we actually thought about what most family bands were like. And we were like, no, no, most family bands kind of suck. Some of them are great. Some of them are fantastic, but yeah, not so great, I think. But that's a thing too. And that's something that I really appreciate is when people can kind of have a mix of like of, you know, I mean, polymath is a nice way to put it. I think probably dilettante is probably closer to what I am. But I think that that's okay. You know, I think it's okay to be a dilettante. I was just talking to one of my nibblings the other day, and, you know, gender neutral nieces and nephews. And we were talking about like wanting to do an artistic thing when you grow up, but also wanting to do something else too. And I was like, yeah, I think that's great. I think that that's, and I think that like, I think there was a time where you could just be one thing, but I don't think that that time really exists anymore. I think that you have to hustle, you know? And I also think that like, and this is something that I'm probably sure you have to keep in mind a lot. I'm a pretty open person. I was born extroverted. Like I've seen videos of myself as a toddler at my brother's little league games. And I'm just going up to everybody going, hi, hi, hi. I love people. I do. I love people. Like I had a picnic for my birthday and I took a picture of it and I sent it to my brother and he goes, I've never seen that many people for a picnic. And I was like, oh yeah. And that was just one of my birthday parties. I had another private one that night. I just know a lot of people. I just know a lot of people. And I'm not cool or popular. I just know a lot of people. But I think that one thing that I never really understood about myself and I didn't really know how to do, and I'm still figuring out how to do, is like what to keep private and how to have my own private life. And I think that I've managed to do that pretty well with romantic stuff. Like, I don't think, like once or twice I may have tweeted about like somebody I was dating, but a lot of the times they weren't that into that. And other times it was just like, well, that's not really anybody's business. Or they weren't on Twitter or Instagram at all, you know? And so I feel like that is something that I've never had a problem with keeping separate, especially since I like every now and then people will be like, come on my podcast where we talk about our sex lives. And I'm like, I can't do that. I have lots of fans that are under 10, you know, I still have people who are fans of my movies from when I was a child. And I think that sexuality and children definitely should not ever mix. So I don't want to disappoint people. And I think that in some ways that's really hindered me in my life because I felt like I always have to be the good girl. I always have to be the good girl. Mm. When I drank, I like never wanted to be photographed drinking, you know, even if I was well over 21, you know, I don't think I ever admitted to like having smoked weed. Well, first of all, I never really liked weed, but I don't think I ever admitted to it until it was 100% legal in California. But there's also, I've realized like I don't have to share so much of myself, and I've kind of taken joy in what is my private life and what is everybody else, you know, what is the me that other people see and what is the me that's just myself. And I think that it's really nice. It's really nice to be able to be like, this is just for me. I have this idea, I have this thought, I have this relationship, and I don't need to share it with the world. And that stuff is kind of sacred.
That's a lot of pressure that you must have felt though before.
Yes. It was, I think that I always felt like I had to be the good girl, but what it meant to be the good girl was to be nice to people even when they weren't being nice to me, or saying yes to things that I didn't want to do. Even when they were things that like just straight up made me uncomfortable, it was like, well, I don't want to cause trouble. I don't want to do this. And thankfully there wasn't anything too horrific in the industry, but I had a lot of like creepy moments with fans where I felt like I couldn't say no, you know, or I had a lot of like weird or just like stupid obligations for things that I felt like I had to do and I didn't like. And you could tell that I was like half-hearted into it because, you know, I kind of wear my heart on my sleeve and I'm painfully expressive. So my stepmother is always telling me, she's like, make sure you don't make that face again. She's like, if you go to some place and you don't like the food, don't make that face you always make. And I'm like, I know. But it was a lot of pressure. And I think the joy of having like my own life that's just for me and just for like, you know, my family and just for like people I have relationships with and my best friends and things like that. That's really nice. And I've also gotten burned a lot of times where I'd put something online in like a group or I'd share with some friends and then they would share that, you know, publicly somewhere. And that's happened to me a lot. And that makes me very sad. It makes me feel like I can't trust people, but it also makes me realize, okay, well, I just need to find the people that I trust and you know, put that into it and you know, relate to them more too. And a lot of the times those people are, you know, artistic or creative people themselves, or they're just very private people, and they understand that. I do think that I have like a much more laid back reaction to a lot of things. A couple years ago, my friend Lisa Jacob, who played my big sister in Mrs. Doubtfire and is one of the best people in the world, she's a lot like me. Like, it's really funny that we were cast as sisters, because like we both studied sociology and writing in college, and we both have anxiety, and we both like didn't like exercise but liked yoga and meditation, and we both like love cats and dogs, and she like, they may feel like little things, but she really does feel like my big sister. And she said that when the NSA thing was revealed, and it was revealed that, you know, they'd been spying on us, she was horrified, of course. But all her friends were like, "Aren't you so surprised?" And she was like, "No." And I was like, and I told her, I was like, "That's really weird. I wasn't surprised either. And I think it's because we grew up realizing that everybody was watching us. And so our paranoia was kind of justified." And it's sad. It's really sad in some ways. And in some ways, but I feel like I've had to live my life where I have to be careful about the way that I treat people and the way that I live my life, because since I was, you know, 5 or 6, somebody has been watching. And I consider myself very fortunate in a way, because I've gotten to be, I mean, I got to play, you know, Matilda, who's this iconic archetype, who was a character that I loved. And now, like, millions of little girls and I mean, kids of whatever gender love, but mostly it's little girls. And I love that. I love that I got to be that, but that was very hard for me. I felt like I was living in her shadow for a long time. And finally, I think one of my teachers in college who, and this teacher actually changed the way that I think, which is an interesting story. She changed the way that I think, like, visually forever. I used to have no visual imagination. And then I took a class in directing and choreography with her, and suddenly I could see images in my head. So she had a massive impact on me. And she said, "I think you should write a letter to Matilda." And I did. And I told her how frustrated I was with her, but also how much I loved her. And that ended up in my book. And I talked about, you know, meeting fans of Matilda, like the night my brother got married. And we went to a dive bar in Savannah, and meeting this woman and her saying, "My niece passed away, and that was my niece's favorite movie." And the two of us just talking, and she congratulated the couple, and they bought us like drinks and songs on the jukebox. And we just had a wonderful time with this couple all night. And I thought about that, and I was just like, somebody was able to find peace and love and catharsis and remember somebody that she loved because of a movie that I was in. And I think that was an incredible feeling. And for a long time, I don't know if it was imposter syndrome or what, but I just couldn't process that. Like, being recognized felt to me like being sung to in a restaurant on your birthday. But then it was suddenly like, oh, I get it now. I get it now. And I'm sad that it took me to like my late 20s to get that. You know, I'm sad it took me 20 years to get it, but I eventually did.
Well, that's a perfect segue, because in a second here, I'm going to ask you to distill some of this wisdom. but in the meantime, we'll take a quick break to hear from our sponsors. And we're back. So you talk about this sort of taking until your late 20s to discover these things. I wonder, because so much of your work life was lived before the age of 21. So for you, me asking you this question is different than most of my guests. If you were able to speak to a 21-year-old version of you in today's world, what advice might you give yourself?
You have a good intuition. You just need to listen to it. You really do. You need to trust yourself. There are so many things you know about the people around you and about yourself that you know to be true. And please, you know, don't hate yourself for them. You are what you are. Accept them about yourself. You know, also, you know, you're not your thoughts. You are what you do with your thoughts, I think, is another one that's good for people with mental health issues. I think to trust your intuition and to be proud and to take pride in things. I think that's something that is very good. And I think to look at yourself objectively is good too, because I know that I kind of tended to swing from, I'm the worst, I'm the best a lot when I was a kid. But that I think is important to look at yourself objectively and to also look at the people around you and remind yourself that, you know, people do like you and you like being with people. And I also think to think more long-term, not just short-term, to think more long-term. But really, I wish I could tell her to trust herself because she didn't. And I think that I spent a lot of time looking to other people and maybe thinking, I think one of the biggest problems I had in my 20s was thinking that people who were mean were correct. Just because somebody is mean doesn't mean they're telling the truth. And just because they think they're telling the truth doesn't mean that they're correct. That I wish is something that I had learned a long time ago. Just because someone's mean, and this is something you see on the internet all the time, being mean does not mean you're right. It just means you're mean. Sometimes people are mean and correct, but it's not necessarily so. So that is something I wish I'd pay attention to and something I'd realized.
God, that's so beautiful and so useful.
Thank you. I'm so glad you think that.
Mara, this is great. I feel like I couldn't have asked for a better guest for this conversation that I to me, this is my favorite conversation to have about, you know, what do you do? Where are you from? What do you deal with?
Yeah.
And I think it's great. And you've done so much and been through so much. And you are such a, I find you like a beacon of hope, even though.
I'm so glad to hear that.
Even though you're a trampoline covered in detritus or.
Yeah, there's paper clips, there's hot sauce packets, there's, you know, a screwdriver, there's, you know, the scotch tape you could never find. Yeah.
I love it. Well, thank you so much. I can't wait till we get to spend a lovely evening together in Austin or wherever
yes.
it may be.
But maybe at the Largo again.
Ooh, I might be there in January. I'll let you know.
I would love that. I love performing there and I love going to shows there. So yeah, it's one of my favorites.
Well, Mara, thank you so much for being on Wheels Off. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been an honor.
All right. Thank you so much for listening to Wheels Off. Please be sure to rate and review the show on iTunes. That helps us appear higher in the search results and lets other folks know that it's a cool podcast to listen to. Also, as the kids say, don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or anywhere else that you listen to shows like this so that you never miss an episode. This has been Wheels Off, and I'm Rhett Miller, encouraging you to create every day. Thanks, y'all.
Osiris.
Hey, this is Dewey Halpas, host of Peer Pleasure on the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Join me each week as I explore another long-form conversation with one of your favorite musicians, actors, comedians, or creatives. From Chino Moreno of the Deftones, John Gorley of Portugal the Man, to Fat Mike from NoFX and Ian MacKay from Fugazi and Minor Threat, we go all over the map. From Fall Out Boy to Slayer, Peer Pleasure has it all. Check us out now on Sound Talent Media.